Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Truth in Movies. On today's episode, awards season is well and truly here, and we review two of the frontrunners, Martin McDonagh's black comedy Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri, and Joe Wright's Winston Churchill biopic Darkest Hour. And speaking of awards, we're flashing back to 1996 for Frances McDormand's Oscar-winning turn in the Coen Brothers classic, Fargo. It's Truth in Movies, a Little White Lies podcast. So, if you're wondering where James is this week, don't worry, he's not regenerated into a northerner after the Christmas episode. This is Michael Eder sitting in, keeping the host's seat warm and wishing Happy New Year to Little White Lies' Grand Fromage, David Jenkins.
Hey.
And Beth Webb, returning guest.
Hello.
2018 already, we're getting into awards season. We had the BAFTA nominations this week and the Golden Globes awards given out over the weekend. David, any takes on that?
I think you're in that sort of relentless churn of kind of awards fodder where you're either reacting to awards being given or nominations being given or potential nominations being given or potential awards being given. So that all kind of keeps going until the end of the Oscars, which, what is it, like the end of March?
It goes on for a long time.
Yeah, it's forever in reality. But yeah, you know, the BAFTAs was kind of, I would say disappointing, but that would infer that I had some kind of investment in the idea that they might do something good. From my perspective, it seemed very sad that the selection of nominees this year seemed very kind of conservative and well-worn, and it is an identity that feels quite kind of conservative and unconnected to conversations and things that are happening in the film world, which are maybe a little bit more interesting. And sad that Greta Gerwig has had no awards love so far.
Well, as far as the BAFTAs are concerned, The Shape of Water, Guillermo del Toro's film, was leading the pack, 12 nominations. And then the two that we're talking today both got 9 nominations each, Darkest Hour and 3 Billboards. But then these critical favourites, festival favourites like Lady Bird, and then genre films like Get Out, seem to be relegated little to screenplay or single acting nominations.
It's sad that those kind of films, like, you know, it's really, really upsetting that Get Out, which was like a massive commercial success, is being kind of overlooked because, you know, it's such a kind of interesting, spiky choice for films.
And, well, this is it. And then when you think about Little White Lies, Call Me By Your Name was, you know, the film of the year, and you just think, am I living in this echo chamber where Get Out and Call Me By Your Name? But then you look at things like box office figures, you look at how well Lady Bird did critically and how well it did on, you know, if you're looking at Metacritic scores as well, and then you come to the BAFTAs and nothing. It's just this kind of eerie silence as things like Darkest Hour and Three Billboards kind of take. And I haven't seen Shape of Water yet. I know you're vouching for it hugely.
I need
to give it a chance, but I was very, if I could do like the Marge Simpson grumble very well, I would, about the shape of the nominations this year so far, and the wins that came through the Golden Globes weren't as fun as I was expecting. I think if you look at the BIFFAs as well, like the calibre of films that came through there, you've got Lady Macbeth, you've got God's Own Country, you know, such interesting and unique stories to tell, and they've been told so well, and not really anywhere to be seen.
And well, one film I know you like, Beth, was I'm Not a Witch, which got a single nomination for Outstanding Debut for the writer, director, and then the producer.
Yeah, I'll be backing that fully. I mean, I was singing its praises on here last episode I was on, and would love to see that happen. You know, Rangana Nyoni won Best Director at the BIFFAs, and I hope this gives her career the real boost that it needs, really.
Hopefully.
One interesting thing I saw is the actor and sometime director Paddy Considine. Did you guys see this?
This was on Instagram yesterday,
yeah. Yeah, he's sort of announced that he's going to no longer be directing movies because it's too much effort and it's not worthwhile for him if he's playing to empty houses, even though the film isn't out for 2 months yet. And
I think give people a chance maybe to make up their minds before he takes to Instagram rants. I haven't seen it. I've heard that it's fine. I think it's very much a film for the public and not the critics as such. I think commercially it might do quite well. And people love Paddy Considine. I love Paddy Considine. Mm-hmm. You know, he's got strong following. I think hang up your hat too.
It's true. I mean, you don't want to have to be like, you know, coming back with your tail between your legs when the film does well commercially. And
But that film's Journeyman and it's due out later this year. And have you reviewed it yet?
Yeah. I think it's a flawed film, but it's certainly not a bad one and certainly not a film that I would, you know, stake my entire directorial career on and think, yeah, this is it. If people aren't going to see this, I'm done. I mean,
and he's still one of the, you know, the best actors of his generation.
Exactly.
You know, the death of Stalin just last year, he was fantastic in those opening scenes.
He was the best thing in that.
Really hope this isn't the time for him to back away.
No. I mean, hopefully he'll do something else with Shane Meadows, because, I mean, that, as a partnership, they're so great.
Because the Donk and Scorsese reunion.
The Donk and Scorsese and Dead Man's Shoes. I mean, they're the sort of Midlands De Niro Scorsese.
That's one way of putting it. You've got to reunite them. So, the listeners, you can let us know what you think of the awards and if there are any snubs that you want pointed out at truthofmovies@tcolondon.com or Little White Lies, LW Lies on Twitter. There's also a comments page on the website, lwlies.com/podcast. Speaking of films, perhaps not getting the attention they deserve on release, we have this email from Yerwin Hoban. For Film Club, I'd like to suggest Jackie Brown, a beautiful film that turned 20 just this Christmas. I regard this as an anomaly in Quentin Tarantino's body of work, as there's a vulnerability and a sense of romance that cannot be found in any of his other films. One of his finest movies. Would love to hear your take on it. Are we fans around the table, guys?
Oh, big time.
I haven't seen it.
Oh really?
So off the back of that recommendation, I will. I can't weigh in, unfortunately.
Well, I think I may have mentioned recently that my kind of big critical turnaround point ever was on the film Death Proof by Tarantino, which is now probably my favourite of his films. But I think, you know, Jackie Brown is like probably a close second. You know, I think all the rest, there is a certain kind of juvenilia element to them now, like even Pulp Fiction and Reservoir Dogs, whereas I think that Jackie Brown is probably the only film he's made by a certified adult. An adult person. So.
It still seems like his most mature work, and not just because of the maturity of the actors involved. It's middle-aged actors who aren't cool in the sort of traditional Tarantino sense. They may strut and spout one-liners, but they're pretty, you know, grotesque or ugly or sort of dowdy figures at times. Robert Forster in particular is just such a straight-up guy, and it's heartwarming for that. Well, that's Jackie Brown, maybe one for a future film club. But for now, let's talk about this week's new releases, and starting with Three Billboards. Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri, starring Frances McDormand as Mildred Hayes, a woman who takes matters into her own hands after her daughter's murder remains unsolved, much to the chagrin of the local coppers. In this clip, Mildred confronts the chief of police, played by Woody Harrelson, with some unorthodox crime-fighting methods.
I'd do anything to catch the guy who did it, Mrs. Hayes, but when the DNA don't match no one who's ever been arrested, and when the DNA don't match any other crime nationwide, and when there wasn't a single eyewitness from the time she left your house to the time we found her, well, right now, there ain't too much more we can do.
Could pull blood from every man and boy in this town over the age of 8.
Their civil rights laws prevents that, Mrs. Hayes. And what if he was just passing through town?
Pull blood from every man in the country, then.
And what if he was just passing through the country?
If it was me, I'd start up a database. Every male baby that's born, stick him on it. And as soon as he'd done something wrong, cross-reference it, make 100% certain it was a correct match, then kill him.
Yeah, well, there's definitely civil rights laws prevents that.
So this is the new film from Martin McDonagh, whose first film was In Bruges, quite a cult favourite, and then maybe strayed a little bit off the path with Seven Psychopaths afterwards.
Without meaning to sound unpopular, I would probably take Seven Psychopaths over In Bruges.
Interesting.
I know.
Why would you do that?
Well,
Is there a casual review there?
I think I probably like the fact that Seven Psychopaths is something of a kind of overreaching folly. Since seeing it at the cinema when it came out. I haven't seen it since. And, maybe I don't really have the inclination to see it again, but I do have maybe fonder memories of it than, like, In Bruges was just, like, kind of, for me, a bit of a shrug. You know, I didn't find much sort of depth to it. But, like, with Seven Psychopaths, there was a sense that he was kind of pushing the envelope a little in terms of, like, narrative and storytelling. And, I mean, whether he does it well or not, I think is maybe up for debate. And clearly the common sense view on this film is that it was a misstep. I don't think many people went to see it. But I really liked it.
One to revisit, perhaps.
Yeah, I think it's actually one that might, in, like, 30 years' time, get re-released on some, like, boutique Blu-ray label and have someone write a really good, like, booklet essay for it.
Mm-hmm. Are you going to write that essay?
Yeah, in 2054, if Arrow Films want me to do that essay, I'm up for it.
But Three Billboards, he reunites with a couple of members of the cast of Seven Psychopaths, two of the psychopaths, in fact, Sam Rockwell and Woody Harrelson, and also Abby Cornish. But his lead is Frances McDormand, a first-time collaborator of his. And David, you wrote the review for The White Lies for this one. How did it land with you?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting. We chose to put this film on the cover of the issue, and we hadn't actually seen it yet because it had previewed at the Venice Film Festival and we hadn't really attended that year. And it had got this kind of groundswell of appreciation from critics, mainly European critics, and it just seemed like a great choice. I mean, we love Frances McDormand, and he's an interesting director, and so I think it's a kind of weird situation when you're going to see a movie that you've already sort of put quite a lot of your chips on creatively.
Yeah.
You know, you're sort of hoping that it's going to meet an expectation. You're hoping that it's going to be good enough to be able to sort of follow through with this idea that you've already kind of set in motion. And I'd seen the trailers, and the trailer tees up this idea is that it's a kind of angry woman film. It's a revenge film. Mm. The impression you get is that the film is going to be a kind of David versus Goliath kind of thing, where, you know, she takes on the police force with these unorthodox methods. But I think the thing I really liked about the film is that it's maybe not that film at all. I mean, it kind of teases you with that notion of being a kind of, let's take on corruption, let's take on police negligence and other kind of deficiencies in that world. But I think it swerves off at the point where it kind of gets to the, where, you know, maybe we're like the sort of end of where the trailer would be. Mm-hmm. And it just swerves off into something different. And it's more about, like, what corruption means. It's more about, like, dealing with the nature of evil and why people take revenge and what actual real world ramifications it has. I've thought about the film a lot since seeing it, mainly because the reaction since that we've run our review and, you know, this initial kind of burst of positivity, there has been something of a quote unquote backlash about certain political elements of the film.
Mm. Well, that's something we should pay some respect to in a way.
Oh, so absolutely.
Backlash is a word that was thrown around when really this is one of those films where it premieres at Venice and then goes to Toronto and it goes a festival run, and with every notch in that bedpost, more people see it, a broader audience sees it, new critics see it. Mm-hmm. And then when it goes on general release in the States and there are more week by week critics seeing it, you just suddenly get this body of opinion where initially what may have seemed like a consensus becomes chipped away or becomes questioned. The sort of the sum of some of these criticisms of the film, I suppose we could get into that. Beth, do you...
I'm slightly on the other side of the fence there. Yeah, I think in terms of the fact that, you know, there's this platform set and you've got Sam Rockwell, and I love Sam Rockwell, I need to say that first and foremost.
So Sam Rockwell plays this...
plays Jason, who is kind of this caricature cop, you know, falling over himself and bumbling around and generally doing a terrible job. But he's widely known throughout the community as a racist, and it's kind of insinuated that he's been violent towards people of colour. And that's when you wait with bated breath. You know, you think, oh, this is happening. You know, we've got a platform here. You know, we've got this huge film with this huge cast, and they're going to take this on. They're going to take on this element. And then he doesn't deliver. I mean, the storytelling is great. Otherwise, it's a film about pain. It's about these people's pains and their suffering. And you really get muddled up in Mildred, you know, Frances McDormand and Woody Harrelson's pains. And you kind of walk around in it. And then I feel like with this area, it was just kind of light social commentary that was never really delivered upon. You know, it's not enough to just point out that this is a very current issue and then just move on, sort of thing. It's almost better to not bring it up at all. I feel like McDonough thought that he had to. Mm-hmm. And then that was him kind of dusting his hands of it almost.
That's almost a contextual issue of the film, really. It's not so much the film's fault that it's released in a year where these issues about sort of abuse of power and representation in front of behind the camera are becoming more and more prevalent.
I guess so, but then this is, you know, an ongoing issue for decades, mm-hmm. you know? He can't be ignorant towards that at all. I think, I mean, it doesn't need to dominate the film by any means. Mm-hmm. He's not by any means gone out to make a film about that, but I feel like he could have spent a lot more time developing that alongside the other storylines.
But that's what I find quite fascinating about the film. It is so slippery thematically and narratively. It takes unexpected turns. Characters, even within one scene, may have conflicted intentions and motivations. Even from that clip that we just listened to, it sets up this almost antagonistic relationship between Woody Harrelson and Frances McDormand's character. But there's actually a basic human warmth and decency behind all that.
Absolutely.
As well.
And there is some incredibly satisfying character development. You know, I didn't feel the same about any of those characters going into the film as I did leaving the film. And without spoiling the plot, there's a key scene between Frances McDormand and Woody Harrelson where attitudes change instantly. Mm. Something happens and Frances McDormand is suddenly from one side of the fence to the other, and you're there with her, absolutely. But yeah, I think there are some very blind areas to that film.
And it's been widely touted that both Frances McDormand and Sam Rockwell are very much in the conversation for winning Best Actress and Best Supporting Actor. Do we think their chances are strong here? Are they doing good work?
I mean, Frances McDormand, I just, you know, don't think it even needs to be said.
No.
I think on that front, though, Rockwell's great in it. But I actually think that the standout supporting turnist was Woody Harrelson as the local sheriff. I can't remember what his actual title
on
is.
On the billboard it says, "How come Chief Willoughby?"
Chief Willoughby, of course, yes. It's a really lovely kind of droll and folksy take on sort of local police enforcer, and he kind of bears some... I'm trying to sort of... If I'm umming and ahhing here, I'm trying to not spoil his kind of arc. But, you know, he bears some heavy loads with a real sense of levity and lightness that only, I think, a real comfortable, masterful actor like him could actually get away with.
That carries it halfway, and then McDormand just takes it the rest of the way. Mm-hmm. I'd like to see her win Oscar for... I mean, she's won the big three, hasn't she? She's won an Oscar, Tony, and an Emmy, and another Oscar, perhaps. Wouldn't it go amiss? I think for Sam Rockwell, this isn't his Oscar role. I'd like to see him nominated in the future for something better. Mm-hmm.
We need Frances McDormand to release a musical album and win the Grammy, so a full EGOT.
I would listen to that. She does do, like, apparently weird experimental theatre in Europe when she's not, like, working on big movies, so...
Is this a Little White Lies?
Maybe it could be
road trip.
Yeah, maybe.
I'm into that.
But that's three billboards. Should we say some scores, maybe, for this? David?
Okay, well, as someone who quite likes Seven Psychopaths, I'd say, and the fact that it got this kind of great reception after Venice and Toronto and whatnot, I would give it 4. And then, yeah, I would probably say 5s for the other two, just because I do, yeah, I liked it a lot. I want to see it again. And I think that the sort of debate that's generated around it is fascinating. And like, whereas I think that it's a film that's really easy to argue both ways on. And I don't buy this idea that kind of ambiguity is a kind of get-out clause for directors. Mm. And, you know, it's a way to sort of slip past criticism. I think that, you know, ambiguity is the kind of, is the meat of movies. And, you know, it's the thing that actually makes them interesting. And that they're a thing to sort of form opinion around, not to, like, give you an opinion. So, yeah, liked it.
Good.
Beth? I went in with a 4. I really like McDonough. Perhaps don't share the views of Seven Psychopaths, but I liked In Bruges. In Bruges, I don't think it's aged very well, but it was good fun at the time. He's gone stateside and he's managed to stay afloat, which not many British directors can necessarily do. 3. And then again, a 3, but I will say one of those is purely McDormand. Like, she absolutely carried that film. Without that, I don't think the film would be even half as good.
Mm. Well, I think personally, gosh, well, McDonough has, you know, he's been so strong from his debut short, Six Shooter, onwards, really. He made an Oscar-winning short before In Bruges. So I'd probably 3 or maybe a 4 anticipation. And yeah, watching it, first time I saw it was in a room with hardly anyone in. But then seeing it with an audience, it really is a good audience picture. It's no surprise that it won the audience prize at Toronto, which is generally a good marker of an awardsy movie. 12 Years a Slave and Room have won it in the past. So maybe a 4 again there. It's certainly a film that it's challenging in terms of it's not what you expect on a moment-to-moment basis, but it's also challenging, as you say, David, in the sense that it challenges what you expect from films like that, from movies. You expect them to give you fully formed themes and narrative drives and causes to rally behind, or are you expected to wrestle with a text, with a filmmaker, with a performance, with a character? And that's all there in that film. And in retrospect, it's been fascinating to see the response to all this. It's inspired great writing, both on the positive and negative sides, during awards season, and also such strong responses from audiences, and can't wait to see what the UK thinks. That's probably three or four, probably four. Again, we'll see how it does at the Academy Awards and the BAFTAs, I guess. And that was Three Billboards, so let's cue up our next awards hopeful, Darkest Hour.
Shaking.
So are you.
You from excitement, I from terror. You've wanted this your entire adult life.
No, since the nursery. What do the public want?
It's your own party to whom you'll have to prove yourself.
I'm getting the job only because the ship is sinking. It's not a gift, it's revenge.
Let them see your true qualities, your courage.
My poor judgment.
Your lack of vanity.
Yeah, my iron will.
Your sense of humour.
Ho, ho, ho.
Now go.
Go?
Be
what?
Be yourself.
Myself. Which self should I be today? One should have had power when a young man, when wits were sharp, sinews strong. Oh, well, lead on, Macduff. When youth departs, may wisdom prove enough.
And so that was Gary Oldman as Winston Churchill, having a chat with Kristin Scott Thomas as his wife. And this is Darkest Hour, the story behind the speech that inspired a nation. But before there's any fighting on the beaches, Winston Churchill must wage a war within the cabinet itself and calm the mutiny brewing within Parliament. So this seems, after Three Billboards, this seems like a very definitely an Oscar awards baity film. Do we agree, guys? What do we think?
100%.
100%.
100%. Yeah, this is a real boomer movie, I think. Just very much set up for a certain audience, and a certain audience that I imagine are quite prominent on the awards boards as well.
And with a performance at its centre, Gary Oldman, a career actor of great renown who hasn't as yet had Oscar glory. Is this going to be his departed in a way, do you think, David?
Well, you know, if it is, it is. and good fair play to him and, you know, all that. But it's interesting because we did, as a film club recently, we did Leon.
Yes. Yeah.
And Gary Oldman in there gives like the most cokey, maniac performance that you've ever seen. And, you know, I kind of was watching this and there is elements of that Leon performance here. It is so big, over the top. I mean, Gary Oldman's known for going big on
Absolutely.
Everything.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I actually find the films where he's a bit more muted. Like, I find watching the sort of the Christopher Nolan Batman films where he plays Commissioner Gordon really strange because he's so just normal in them.
Yeah.
And I'm like, it's like getting the wrong tool for the job there. You know, you just want some kind of journeyman character actor in that role rather than like someone like him who could, exactly. You know, who should really be the villain or something.
Yeah, absolutely.
But yeah, this film is, it couldn't be more prestige British biopic from Joe Wright, who is a director who has been around the block many, many times now, and he almost has started to feel part of the kind of British prestige cinema furniture. And yet I've never seen a film of his that I've truly liked. And that's not to say that I don't think what he does is impressive or he's got a visual eye or something like this. I just, mostly it's the material that he picks that just doesn't seem to gel with me and, you know, the stories that he chooses to tell.
Let's run through that. So Atonement is the big one, the big Joe Wright film that announced him and set him off on his way. Then Pride and Prejudice?
I think Pride and Prejudice,
was
first.
Before.
Oh, was that before?
Yeah,
right.
Yeah. Pride and Prejudice, then this.
And
then
Anna Karenina.
Then we've had his Anna Karenina.
Hannah.
I mean, Hannah was the one where I thought, oh, this is the film where he's actually kind of thought, to hell, I'm going to do something weird and a bit left field. Mm. And even that, even him attempting to do something that was a bit more kind of zeitgeisty,
yeah,
fell flat. I mean, you know, for me, that film was just about how great Saoirse Ronan is.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And a small role for Jessica Barden, who's now in The End of the Effing World on Netflix. And showed up in The Lobster, and it's worth going back just for her scene.
I love Jessica Barden. I really enjoyed the episode of Black Mirror he did.
Oh, really? Which one was that?
This, I forget what it's called, but it was the first episode of the last series where they're rating everyone's interactions with...
Is that Bryce Dallas Howard?
Bryce Dallas Howard, which was the, you know, the season premiere of The Last Black Mirror. And that was great fun. Maybe he should dabble a little bit more in telly and less in drab films.
I think, you know, this isn't meant to sound like a diss, but I think Joe Wright could definitely, if he had a really well-written TV series.
And a good budget. You were saying, we were speaking about this the other day, and you said, God, Joe Wright just loves to direct, and he just directs the hell out of everything. Like, just redirects.
Well, that's what he does here, isn't it? It's quite a chamber piece in a way. It's lots of conversations in Parliament or in the War Cabinet's offices and so on, and lots of scenes of process of behind-the-scenes wheeler-dealering between MPs, but then also speech writing for, as Winston Churchill creates what will become this great iconic myth-making speech. But Joe Wright decides to throw a camera around and go for these swooping aerial shots of the Commons, or there's one point where this film is in a way a prequel or a precursor to Dunkirk. But
well, it's like the yin to Dunkirk's yang, really.
Exactly.
I mean, it's where Dunkirk avoids all the kind of boring fat blokes pushing little figures across a map. this film is just that.
Go back to the directing aspect. It's almost like Danny Boyle had to go at the editing transitions. There's these really strange moments where the calendar pops across the screen and changes, and a really strange moment where a boy closes his hand into darkness, and that's like the transition. And you just think, what are you doing?
The feeling I got from this film is that its makers were either told or believed that the story they were telling was inherently boring.
Yeah.
And that they had to do something, anything, to make it more exciting.
Mm-hmm.
And by doing that, it's so nakedly obvious that they're doing that, it just ruins the whole film. I just thought it was bad.
Well, it's distracting, isn't it? The cinematographer is Bruno Delbonnel, who's done some fantastic work. In fact, Inside Llewyn Davis was a film that he shot for the Coen brothers.
I mean, Inside Llewyn Davis, they do lots of things with, like, dusty light. I think that cinematographer is known for. And there's so much dusty light in this film. I mean, there's too much. I mean,
it's irritating. I know it's supposed to cause this kind of, you know, this feeling of being claustrophobic, and it's very like elusive, but it just got on my nerves. And you think, you know, Gary Oldman spent over 200 hours in makeup for this role. You see half his face. He needn't have bothered. You know, I was on board for a split second. There was this tracking shot across sort of central London, which was kind of reminiscent of those really ambitious scenes from Atonement, the big battle scenes. And for a second I thought, well, this is going to be, you know, at least visually quite assertive. And then he just retreats into the shadows for the rest of the film. And it's distracting. It reminds you of kind of those studio era films where they kind of blacked out the size to hide how cheaply it was made. And it's just, yeah, very distracting, very irritating, and just completely reduce those big, beautiful speeches that he gives, because, you know, he's kind of immersed in darkness. You can't see anyone reacting to the speeches. And it just completely, yeah, derailed it for me.
For the first hour, I was never with it, but I was always willing to sort of say, well, this could go either way. And then pretty much at the halfway point, it just tumbled for me, like it just died. There's a scene which we can't talk about, I guess, because it happens right near the end of the film. But I think we can allude to it, which is maybe one of the most idiotic.
Oh, my God.
is this the scene I'm thinking?
It's just like I was watching it with my wife, and we came out after, and we were just like, the first thing we said was, that cannot be real. I mean, that sequence, I mean,
it's positioned at such a standout point in the arc of the character. It's where he's at his lowest ebb and he needs some inspiration, so he finds it. So they really go big in terms of, how to draw inspiration from the people, let's say.
Yes.
And I'd say it's one of the most embarrassing and cringeworthy scenes I've seen in a film in memory, I'd say. It plays like a Saturday Night Live parody.
it really does. I mean, I guess one of the other issues of the film, in the review that we've run, not by me, by a colleague, Trevor Johnston. So he apparently went to the press screening of the film, and Joe Wright was present at the screening to give an intro, which is kind of weird for a press screening because, you know, it's just a run-of-the-mill thing. And he was essentially there to explain that the film had been made, or at least conceived and, you know, written pre-Brexit. Mm. And that although it may look like it now as a kind of clarion call for, like, you know, nationalism and rejection of Europe, that actually that wasn't its intention. It was just intended as a kind of celebration of like British political oratory and a character study. But, you know, going back to what you're saying about Three Billboards and Beth, about the idea of a film existing in a moment and having to kind of contend with reality, and this question of whether films can exist in a bubble on their own and not be kind of affected by the kind of tide of politics or sort of social issues. And yeah, I mean, you watch this film and you do kind of think that the sort of UKIP massive are going to... They're going to probably have quite a nice time with it.
Exactly. I mean, it's not our job to engage with that kind of... And I'm trying really hard to disengage from the broader context in this instance because it's so close to home and because I have very, you know, strong views to one side. But people are either going to love or hate this film based on that and this moment in time that we are existing in. So
I really don't think it's a spoiler to mention this, but the second time I watched it, I sat through right to the very end of the credits, and it ends with the bongs of Big Ben, which seems like that's almost the Nick Fury coming out at the end of Iron Man for Brexiters, in a way. So I think the audience will love that.
That's very funny.
So should we put some numbers on this?
Can I add one more little thing? Because I think it's worth talking about. And another sort of criticism of this film, which I think is very valid, that Lily James is in it, who is, you know, a big up-and-coming actress. She's had many sort of breakout roles.
Yeah.
Baby Driver.
She was in Cinderella.
The zombie Pride and Prejudice. Yeah. Jay should have directed that movie.
And I also can't remember a more thankless role than hers in this film, where she plays Churchill's secretary. And there's no role beyond basically looking at Churchill in awe at what he does and from the sidelines. And...
In awe or in a state of disrobement in a way as well.
Yes.
We didn't say that in the first half of the film, it's very much almost a comedy of errors of manners, of Churchill swearing and smoking and bumbling around. The cat is under the bed and et cetera.
And Lily James sort of is, her role is kind of distressed onlooker for most of the mm-hmm. film. And that kind of develops into like awed onlooker. By the end, it feels so token. If you took that role out of the film, the film would be exactly the same.
I feel like she's supposed to be us, isn't she? We're supposed to be the onlookers. We're supposed to be the people coming into the, especially a younger generation who don't, well, I'd say I don't really know Churchill that well, but he's been that prominent in TV and film recently. Like John Lithgow in The Crown, who did a really great job, to be honest. Kristen Scott Thomas didn't have that much to do other than, you know, bustle in and straighten his tie and give him a bit of a kick up the bum and then leave. You know?
I think KST was watching the film thinking, oh, I wish this had been about her character.
Yes.
You know, how interesting would that have been to have that story refracted through her view and her kind of feelings.
It is fascinating, though, to see how many films can be made pretty much out of the same little span of time. This is so The King's Speech as well. It's redone with a flip. So you have Ben Mendelsohn in this as the King, playing the role that Colin Firth won an Oscar for. And then you have Gary Oldman taking the reins of, you know, Timothy Spall had a cringeworthy cameo in King's Speech as Churchill. And it just feels like we're in this era of British prestige cinema where we can laugh a little bit the boorish oafishness or the trappings of the great men in our history, but also there needs to be the third act where they come through and inspire the people.
And this is why one of my most anticipated films of this year is a film called Peterloo by Mike Leigh, which is about a kind of famous historical event set in Manchester. And it's like, thank God that he's doing something that's actually like a sort of, you know, relatively unknown, little known episode in British history rather than like trawling over the same old ground, you know.
Well, they're excited for Peterloo, but how do we feel about Darkest Hour? Beth, what numbers are you thinking?
2 across the board. I've gone right. in terms of I quite enjoyed Atonement. I really liked the adaptation of Pride and Prejudice. I mean, I was a younger woman then, so perhaps if I revisited, my feelings would have changed. But yeah, not really on board with him. Didn't engage with the film whatsoever. Like, I just did not engage. I was not invested in the story at all. I mean, I like the film less because of what it's done for the awards season, but then that's not the fault of the film. That's the fault of the boards and who's in charge of making those decisions. But just absolutely uninvested, unengaged, disengaged. Yeah, just twos all around.
David?
I kind of like Gary Oldman, and, you know, probably my anticipation was a little bit higher, maybe 3, just because it had there had been a certain amount of buzz from, you know, festivals and whatnot. But yeah, while watching it, it's probably down to a 2, because I was with it for a certain amount of it, but then it kind of just lost me at a point. And then just 1 in retrospect. It's just, you know, I'm not going back there.
As you said, I quite respect Joe Wright's, you know, director's vision and eye. The fact that he's being so overwrought, I'm trying to make that pun work, is quite, in this time of Netflix TV where everything looks the same, or Marvel films where they all look the same, I quite appreciate that. And I do like Gary Oldman. If you go back and think about the films in the late 80s and 90s, that run he had where it's Prick Up Your Ears, JFK, Leon, etc., True Romance, it's just incredible. So seeing him on screen in a role like this. I also love Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, which was his last big role. So it's probably a 3 or a 4 in anticipation. Enjoyment, yeah, it doesn't look good there. It's a 2, and it really doesn't stand up for a rewatch. So probably a 2 in retrospect as well. Well, that's the darkest hour, but there is some light coming our way. We're going to go back in time to the 1990s for Film Club for Fargo.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds. And they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
So I'm tending bar down there at Eklund and Swedlin's last Tuesday, and this little guy's drinking, and he says, so where can a guy find some action? I'm going crazy out there at the lake. And I says, what kind of action? And he says, woman action. What do I look like? And I says, well, what do I look like? I don't arrange that kind of thing. And he says, but I'm going crazy out there at the lake. And I says, yeah, but this ain't that kind of place. He says, oh, so I get it. So you think I'm some kind of jerk for asking, only you don't use the word jerk.
I understand.
Then he calls me a jerk, says, last guy thought he's a jerk is dead now. So I don't say nothing. He says, what do you think about that? And I says, well, that don't sound like too good a deal for him then.
You got that right.
Yeah. He says, yeah, that guy's dead, and I don't mean of old age. And then he says, geez, I'm going crazy out there at the lake.
White Bear Lake?
Yeah, well, at Eklund and Swedlin, that's closer to Moose Lake, so I made that assumption.
Oh, sure.
Anyway, he's drinking at the bar, so I don't think a whole great deal of it. But then Mrs. Mora, she heard about the homicides down here and thought I should call it in, so I called it in. End of story.
Well, what does this guy look like, anyways?
Oh, he's a little guy, kind of funny looking.
Uh-huh. In what way?
Oh, just in a general kind of way.
Okay.
So, Film Club this week. It's the mid-90s classic, the film that won Frances McDormand her first Oscar, we'll see, later this year. The Midwestern dark crime comedy Fargo. Very much a contender for the best Coen Brothers film in many people's minds, I think. What do the listeners think? David, you got some tweets there?
On that note, before we go into the tweets, I just want to say, one of the things that I think is great about the Coen Brothers is that everyone has a different favourite film.
Of course.
As much as Fargo is a true story, that is a true statement. So what Dre V. Sanchez says, such a difficult question. Love all Coen Brothers movies. Today I would place this 3rd after No Country for Old Men and The Big Lebowski. I know tomorrow it might be number 1 for me. Ranking always changes. So Lucy Nell Crater, one phenomenal performance, script is awesome, the tragicomedy of it all, if that's a word, English is not my first language, is what sticks for me. It's deadly serious, there's suspense, but it's also damn funny. I've not watched the series. I've been told it's awesome. I two have not watched the series.
So. I've only watched one episode. Beth, have you seen the series?
First series is great. Yeah, I think Martin Freeman in that is flawless. Absolutely flawless. I forget he's British a lot of the time, and this was a good example of that.
And have you got any tweets for us to share?
Yeah, Paul Felon, still love Raising Arizona 2, one of those eternally quotable films. Martin Coleman says, I love this film. Macy is cracking. And Joseph William Carr just says, number one, exclamation mark, which is to the point.
Oh yeah, Macy is cracking. You were sharing some trivia earlier about how he wasn't the first choice for that role.
Yeah, Bill Pullman. That would have been a very different film with Bill Pullman in the lead. I don't think I would have liked that half as much.
But how does Fargo stand up on a rewatch, do you think, now, 20 years on?
I think it's pretty good. yeah. You know, I'm a big fan of the Coens, but it's never been one of the films that would have ranked top of the pile. Mm. I think I'd probably prefer some of their more eccentric stuff. I mean, it's interesting the sort of timeline that the film arrived in, because they'd had their early successes with Blood Simple, Barton Fink and Miller's Crossing. Mm. And then they were kind of, after that, given the keys to the kingdom to make Hudsucker Proxy, which cost loads and loads of money and tanked. And I don't know, it feels like a kind of response to that, where they've made something that's very, very different into it's very stripped back, simple, very, very kind of starkly plotted and quite brutal in its outlook. And, you know, perhaps it's the film of theirs which kind of implanted this idea that of them being kind of high cynics, of them having this kind of very, very dour, very negative worldview, that the world is essentially kind of predicated on evil and wrongdoing, and everything is going to happen for the worst, which I think, you know, they came back to in a big way in a film like A Serious Man later on. But one thing I find very strange about it is that McDormand, who won Best Actress, and she doesn't really come into the film for, like, is it like 30 minutes, 45, 40 minutes?
Oh, I think it's shorter than that. It feels like a while, but she comes in maybe 20 minutes, I'd
20
say.
20 minutes, okay.
You spend a lot of time with Macy and then Buscemi and Stormare, don't you, to begin with? And they set up the crime before the cop comes in. It's interesting you mentioned that this was a response to Hudsucker Proxy, because it does play now like almost an archetypal mid-90s film. This sort of, it's playing with genre, it's playing with a sense of America, very, you know, very kind of post-Tarantino-esque film in a way, with Steve Buscemi and the rat-a-tat dialogue and so on. And when people talk about Coens-esque as an adjective, they're probably thinking about this film.
It's true. I mean, those early films were definitely like leeching off of classical Hollywood influences and like hard-boiled fiction. And this feels like the first film where it's very much their own thing. I mean, there's this whole kind of mythology behind the film that because it has this subtitle at the beginning saying this is a story, the names have been changed out of respect for them. You know, they've gone to town on that sort of declaration, which has since been overturned, and they themselves have said the only thing that's true about this film is that it's a story. So I generally hate films that say based on true events, because, you know, if it's got human beings in it, there's going to be some element of truth in it.
And that opening title card then inspired the film Kumiko the Treasure Hunter, which came out a few years ago. It was a sort of small festival film with Rinko Kikuchi in. Did you see that film?
Yeah, where she goes to search for Carl Shoalwater's buried
money,
suitcase of money.
She's
in Fargo.
A Japanese kind of
treasure hunter
/ dropout who sees a very grainy VHS copy of Fargo, and from that is trying to figure out where it's buried. And then it's actually like a nervous breakdown movie, isn't it? Really, but it's a very sad, strange, curious film.
Yeah, really. Worth
how did this stand up for you, Beth?
I watched it just in the most perfect circumstances, in that I haven't seen it for years, so couldn't remember half as much about it as I thought I did, and then just came into it almost completely afresh. The tone is just so satisfyingly balanced, I think. Like, you've got just such a wonderful combination of humour and this kind of darkness that you say is kind of transcends from their other earlier work. And then they've got Frances McDormand, and I mean, just her performance in itself. There's something so interesting about her face. I realize how basic that sounds. But just something where it's just, there's nothing but yet everything going on at the same time. And, you know, these conversations that she has. I especially like the scene where she's interviewing the sex workers and trying to get a little bit of information out of them. I think that was quite new at the time as well. Just completely devoid of judgment. She's just open and receptive of the story. And really pregnant, just super pregnant. But you don't, I love how that's kind of, that sort of adds this huge weight to the whole, I mean, literally, but also it adds this whole weight to every scene that she's in. And yet it's never really acknowledged. It's never really dealt upon. It's never seen to slow her down. Mm-hmm. It's never seen as like a critique of her character. It's just there and it's a part of her. Just adds this kind of wordless extra depth to the film, which I think you miss in so much storytelling now.
I love that pregnancy element to the film, especially after like a film like Raising Arizona, which is kind of about this the kind of anxiety of childbirth.
Yeah,
I love the idea that in Fargo, you know, she's the only kind of good character, and because of that, she's the only one who gets to procreate.
I mean, Norm's pretty great. Norm's pretty harmless.
Norm is the husband, so yeah. he's also there as well.
Yeah.
So the sort of love story between Norm and Marge is in itself delightful. I mean, you know, where he kind of gets up and makes her eggs, insists that she eats her eggs before she goes. Mm-hmm. It's just this kind of, you know, little kind of love is...
Yeah, you only ever see them either in bed or eating together. It's just such a cozy depiction of a relationship on screen. I think it's so fascinating to watch Fargo now in the same week as Three Billboards, because there are echoes between them, but they're just the flip of each other. You know, Fargo has such a satisfying end and characters that you really do love and respond to, even the wrong ones like William H. Macy's character.
I didn't empathise with him whatsoever. I thought he was very silly and he got everything that was.
But he just digs himself deeper and deeper into it.
I think that's another Coen-esque trait is the kind of the character who just is kind of reaching for something that they're never going to be able to grab. I mean, and like, you know, in a film like No Country for Old Men, I think, is about that. Just a person who's just thought, I'm going to grab for something and it suffer the consequences for it. And, you know, he does that in this film. And, yeah, he does seem perfect in his kind of jittery nervousness. And I think the scene where him and McDormand's interviewing him in his office and he's kind of getting more and more agitated and then eventually kind of drives off. I mean, it's just perfect.
It's a perfect visual gag where you just see him just pulling out of the driveway, out of the window. It's just terrific, isn't it? So you teased that this wasn't your favourite and you prefer the more eccentric ones, but where would it come in your Coen's list, David?
I don't know. There are so many that I like. I mean, at the top of the table is probably something like interchangeable between something like The Man Who Wasn't There and Inside Llewyn Davis and No Country for Old Men. I really like The Hudsucker Proxy as well, actually. I've actually got a lot of time for Intolerable Cruelty as well, which I find really, really good, which was their first kind of, I guess, for hire job. I actually think Hail Caesar is wonderful as well. So, I mean, a strange film in their canon.
Beth?
Revisiting this ranks pretty high. For me, it's always been sort of interchangeable between Miller's Crossing and Inside Llewyn Davis. Mm-hmm. Burn After Reading, I've reminded me, is a family favourite. That's a big a big hit with the webs. Not necessarily the best film, but definitely a lot of fun. George Clooney, I love in that film. But this one is just creeping up to the top spot after rewatching. Just, again, it's the McDormand factor. Just knocks out the park. And I'm a real sucker for that Minnesota nice... A real sucker for that aspect of the film, really. So
it's really rare, I think, to see a Coen Brothers character who is so unequivocally nice who isn't made to suffer.
Right.
They, you know, you generally see the kind of, you know, the nice guys in their films. They're made to sort of suffer gruelingly.
They're put through the ringer a little bit.
Exactly. Yeah. Mm. So obviously she's in this kind of dark world where she's dealing with these horrible murders and these, you know, revolting people who, you know, for whom evil seems just depthless, really. But yeah, it's interesting on that front, I think.
Well, that was Fargo. And looking ahead, what do you have to look forward to next week then, David?
So next week, we're going to be looking at... So we've got two pretty big new releases. The new one from The Beard, not you. the other beard, Steven Spielberg, and his film The Post,
mm-hmm.
which is about the Washington Post Pentagon Papers scandal, which kind of links to the Vietnam War. And it's got two gigantic performances from Meryl Streep and Tom Hanks in it. We've also got Lee Unkrich's Coco, which is the new Pixar film.
I can't wait for that one.
Set in and around the Mexico's Day of the Dead, mm-hmm. and a kind of fantasy based on that. And for Film Club is a film which, have any of us seen this?
I haven't seen it.
No.
I haven't seen this either, so I'm excited to maybe partake in the game next week. But it's a movie called Absence of Malice,
mm-hmm.
a film about journalism.
Sidney Pollack, early 80s.
Pollack film about journalism. And yeah, I can't say I know too much more about that, but it would be great. On that note, I think we need your comments more than ever for this one. So next week's Film Club, Absence of Malice, is going to be a real journey of discovery.
Yeah, it's quite a deep dive one for Film Club. So please do send in your comments. That's truthandmovies@tcolondon.com or Twitter @LWLies. Anything else to talk about? Anything looking ahead, Beth?
If I may plug.
Oh, go ahead.
So I'm multi-platform editor over at Ranimax, which is Channel 4's short film strand. And we've got two new series coming up this year on Channel 4, which is very exciting. And I'm part of a film collective called the Bechdel Test Fest, which is a feminist film collective. And we've got a screening as part of the London Short Film Festival next week, which is a retrospective of films by Matty Diop, who is an actress and director.
Fantastic.
If you're in the city,
David, anything to look forward to from Little White Lies?
Timing-wise, I mean, maybe by the time you've listened to this podcast, you'll see what our new issue is, which we're launching imminently. But the name has been mentioned on the podcast today of our cover film, and I think it's one that is going to be beloved by many people, and probably, you know, it's part of the awards talk at the moment. One of the big hitters, I think. So we got that to look forward to.
Oh, yeah, can't wait.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll have to see about that, and we'll see you next week. Thank you, Beth, and thank you, David, for joining me today. And thanks for listening, and we'll see you again next week. This was, as always, a 7 Digital production.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.